Hello and welcome to Lectionary Lunch at Concordia Seminary. We will be looking at the texts for, let's see, it must be Sunday, September, what's this coming Sunday? This coming Sunday must be, today's the 9th, so this coming Sunday must be the 12th, something like that. And so it must be for the 19th. Does that sound right? Anyway, the Old Testament reading is from Jeremiah chapter 11. It's very brief, and it's a little odd, to be real honest, as a pericope to read from the chancel or to preach on, taken out of its context like it is. And one of the things that I want to stress from the outset is how important it is for these verses, Jeremiah 11, verses 18 to 20, how important it is to read them within the context of two chapters in Jeremiah, Jeremiah 11 and 12. And in these chapters, it is, in the section of Jeremiah where there is a lot of judgment, a lot of woe being declared through Jeremiah to the people because of the punishment that finally is falling on them for their sins and the sins of their fathers in the coming of the Babylonians. And but in this particular two-chapter section, there is a lot of, you might say, personal reflection or even personal grieving, personal lamenting on the part of Jeremiah as the prophet, but also on the part of Yahweh himself. So our verses can be thought of, verses 11 to 20, as one of Jeremiah's laments in this section. He has two sections where he himself is lamenting. He is acknowledging the way that the people have turned against him, and not only the people in general, but specifically in these chapters, the men of Anatot, his hometown, have plotted and schemed against him for his life. Now, we don't have a lot of information about this episode in the book of Jeremiah other than this section where it's implied that this is what's going on. But Jeremiah is lamenting that his own kinsmen, you might say, have turned against him because of the word of the Lord, because of his speaking the word of the Lord, and they're plotting to kill him. And he laments for the first time in verses 18 to 23. Our pericope is the first portion of that. He then has a second lament in chapter 12, verses 1 through 6. And in these two chapters, Jeremiah's two laments are surrounded, you might say, by Yahweh's own laments. The beginning of chapter 11, verses 1 to 17, is Yahweh's great mourning or lament over the turning away of his covenant people from his word. So in chapter 11, the end of verse 4, God is reminding them of what he did for them when they came out of Egypt. So you shall be my people and I will be your God, was his promise to them if they would keep his word. He rebukes them as the section goes on in 11, verse 9. It says, "And the Lord said to me, a conspiracy exists among the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem." A conspiracy against the Lord. And that's the kind of thing that's going on then also in microcosm, you might say, against Jeremiah personally within Jeremiah's laments. At the end of, towards the end of this section in 11 verse 14, Yahweh says, "Therefore do not pray for this people or lift up a cry or prayer on their behalf, for I will not listen when they call to me in time of their trouble. What right has my beloved in my house?" Think of the way that the Lord is speaking to his people, that they're his own dear people. It's very intimate language. "What right has my beloved in my house when she has done many vile deeds?" And so just as Yahweh's own dear people have turned away from him, the prophet finds his own family, you might say, rebelling against or scheming against him in our section. Many of the images between Yahweh's laments over his people and Jeremiah's lament over the scheming of his own family against him, many of the images play back and forth as well. So that in chapter 11, verse 16, it says, "The Lord once called you a green olive tree, beautiful with good fruit, but with the roar of a great tempest he will set fire to it, and its branches will be consumed." So God's judgment on his people is pictured as the consuming of a green tree, of a healthy green tree. Later on in Jeremiah's second lament, in chapter 12, verse 3, he speaks about the wicked in the land. He says, "You plant them and they take root. They grow and produce fruit." So he uses the same tree imagery. He also says, he prays that the Lord will pull them out like sheep for the slaughter and set them apart for the day of slaughter. And these two images of a sheep led to slaughter and of the pulling up of a green tree, both of these are in our text as well in verses 11 to 8, or chapter 11, 18 to 20, as Jeremiah laments the schemes of his own family against his own life as a prophet. So that sets it into context a little bit. The point is there's a great interplay going on in these chapters between the relationship between Yahweh and his people and the relationship between Jeremiah and a slice of the people, the men of Anatot, his own kinsmen who have turned against him. Well, with that, let's jump into the text. Verse 18 begins kind of abruptly from the preceding. It's just said that the Lord of hosts, who planted you, has spoken evil against you on account of the evil of the house of Israel and the house of Judah, which they did by burning incense or by provoking me, Yahweh is saying, by provoking me by burning incense to the Baals. Then all of a sudden in verse 18, the voice shifts from Yahweh's voice to Jeremiah's voice, and he says, "V'Yahweh hodiani v'eda'ah, az hir itani ma'al lehem." And Yahweh has shown me, and Yahweh, or now Yahweh, has shown me the hithil of yada, with the first common singular suffix on the end, hodiani, has shown me. And then a verb from the same root, and I know, or and I knew, right? A vav consecutive, first person imperfect from yada, with an extra hey on the end. This is just probably a paragogic hey. So now Yahweh has shown me, and I know, or and I knew. We're in Jeremiah 11, verses 18 to 20, for our newcomers here. Middle of verse 18 with Oz, then he showed me or made me see. You see the hifil of ra'ah there, so causative. Caused to see with the ani on the end, first common singular object suffix. Caused me to see, and ma'aleel is a word for deed or work. And you see that it has a type 2 suffix on the end indicating that it's a plural noun. Their deeds. So this is kind of strange. It's coming out of nowhere. It's a little hard to see exactly what the antecedents of the pronouns are, exactly what Jeremiah is referring to here. But somehow, Yahweh has caused him to know something, and he now knows it. And then he caused me to see their deeds. Now, who's the they and what are the deeds? That's going to become more clear as we read forward here. So he leaves it vague at the beginning. Because this begins so abruptly, many critics assume that the text is disrupted here and out of order, and they actually propose reordering it so that it follows in a more orderly progression of thought. But in fact, if we think of this as a lament and put it alongside many of the laments in the Psalms, many of the laments just burst out with a cry of need that's a little unclear at the beginning and then begin to flesh out what the need is as we move along. Verse 18 had Yahweh as the subject. Now verse 19 begins with a disjunctive vav plus the independent pronoun ani, but as for me. So it's disjunctive indicating a change in subject. V'ani kekeves aluf yuval lit voak. All right, this would be a very straightforward phrase if it didn't have the word aluf in there. It would say, but as for me, like a lamb was being led to slaughter, or like a lamb which was being led to slaughter. Slaughter there is the infinitive construct of tavak, the verb that means to slaughter, with a lamed on the front. And keves is the word for lamb. So, but as for me, or you might say, but I was like a lamb being led. You have the imperfect there of yaval. Yaval in the hifil means to lead or to present for as an offering. And here it's the hofal form. You don't see a whole lot of hofals, but there's one, yuval. And it has, because it's imperfect, kind of a past progressive sense. I was like a lamb being led to slaughter. What complicates it is that aluf there, and that word aluf can mean a couple different things. It can mean clans or chiefs in a number of the books of the Old Testament. It can also have the sense, oftentimes in Proverbs or Psalms, or here in Jeremiah, and it's three uses in Jeremiah, it has the sense of a close companion, a trusted, dear companion or friend. That's probably its sense here, and that's the way that most English translations take it, but even assuming that's what it's mean, that's what it means, it's a little hard to decide what to do with it grammatically. So they say something like a gentle lamb or a tender lamb. Presumably reading this noun, aluf, dear close friend, as a tributive genitive, a lamb of a friend or something like that, but really kind of as an abstract of gentleness or closeness or friendliness, friendly lamb or something like that. The other possibility would be to read lamb here as a construct, like a lamb of a close friend, which doesn't really have a straightforward logical sense, but it does kind of introduce this whole note of betrayal, right? So like a lamb of a close friend being led to slaughter. I'm not exactly sure how to take it. Probably it's best just to stay with the English translations on that and not make a big deal about it. A gentle lamb being led to slaughter. Why was he like a gentle lamb being led to slaughter? Because v'lo yadati ki, and I didn't know that. Ki after a verb of knowing has the sense of that, indicating the object of the knowing. I didn't know that alai kashavu makashavot. I did not know that alai, against me, here all has the adversative sense, that against me they kashaved makashavot. A cognate accusative here. Both the verb and the direct object are from kashav, to think or reckon or consider. I did not know that they thought or planned plans against me, or schemed schemes against me. Then all of a sudden it launches into a reporting of what the plans were. And the last word on this page of BHS, nashkita, is a cohortative, a plural cohortative from shakat, to ruin or wipe out or spoil. And it's a first common plural cohortative, so let us ruin, let us spoil, eitz balakmo, a tree or the tree in its bread or with its bread. Now this is a little strange, lechem here, right? Many of the commentators and even the footnote here in BHS recommends that you leave off the mame, or regard it as an enclitic mame, just there for the pronunciation, so that the word here actually is not lechem, but lake, which means sap, with its sap. That makes a little more sense with tree, right? Let us wipe out the tree in its sap, so in its time of flourishing and growing, right? Kind of like the reference to the olive tree up above, the lush olive tree that Israel was to the Lord, but he's going to tear it up and burn it up. This is their plan against Jeremiah now. Let us wipe out the tree in its sap. The English translations here read actually the lechem as bread, but they take it metaphorically and they usually translate it fruit. Let us wipe out the tree with its fruit. But probably the Hebrew here is talking about the tree's health and vigor in its sap, in the time of its sap. V'nikratenu me'eretz chaim. And let us karat, another cohortative, first common plural, and let us cut off him, enu. Enu can either be first common plural or a third masculine singular ending. Here in this context, it has to be third masculine singular. Let us cut him off from the land of the living. Ushamo lo yitzaker od. And his name, not it will be remembered, the nifal of zakar, so it makes it passive. It will not be remembered any longer. Now, probably here after two cohortatives, it makes sense to read this imperfect with a jussive sense. So, let us do this, and let us do this, and let his name not be remembered any longer. Ode. All right, any questions on 18 or 19? All right, verse 20. Vayaweh Tzevaot Shofet Zedek. Bokein Kalayot Valev. This begins simply with, and Yahweh of hosts, a judge of righteousness, right? Shofet Zedek. But we know, we're going to learn from the second line of verse 20 here, this is why you always have to read everything in its context, that Yahweh is actually being addressed in the second person here. And what that tells you when he's being addressed in the next line in the second person, directly you, is that we take this opening line as a vocative, right? O Yahweh. And if we read it as O Yahweh, then it would make most sense to read that participle, shofet, not as a substantive, a predicate nominative, O Yahweh of hosts is a judge, but probably as a relative clause. So we end up taking it as really an attributive participle here. So, but O Yahweh of hosts, who judges tzedek. Tzedek is just the noun righteousness, but here it's acting as an adverbial accusative. It's a noun acting like an adverb. So, O Yahweh of hosts, who judges righteously, we would say, or in righteousness. Now we have another call participle, bokein, who tests or proves kidneys and heart. Okay, who tests and proves kidneys and heart. Or you might say examines the kidneys or the heart. The kidneys in Hebrew are the seat of the emotions. And the heart, where we think of as the seat of the emotions, is the seat of the will or the mind or a thought. So he weighs the motives and the convictions, you might say, something, or the other way around, I suppose, the convictions and the motives. This word, bakein, is actually it has the sense of to test by smelting, and it's usually used of metal. But more often in the scriptures, it's used of men or the mind or the heart. So God judges righteously. He tests the kidneys and the heart. In other words, you're fair, Yahweh. I know that you're fair, and so here's his request on the basis of Yahweh's justice and clear sight. Eryeh nikmataka mehem. I will see your nikma, your vengeance. Nakam is the verb to avenge in Hebrew. This is the noun form. I will see your vengeance because of them or upon them. Eryeh here probably is cohortative. It's probably the prophet's plea, but there's no special cohortative form for third hey verbs. So you just have to assume that from the context. Let me see your vengeance because of them. For to you, giliti et rivi. For to you, I have revealed or uncovered my reeve, my complaint, my case, my cause, my dispute. All right, that's the end of the text. And it's not a lot of text, like I said, to construct a sermon on. In the first verse, he addresses Yahweh as the one who has made known these secret things. He's made known the deeds of them, whoever the them is, to him. Then he kind of backtracks and he says, I was like a lamb being led to slaughter. I didn't know that they were scheming schemes against me. And then in the third verse, he says, he appeals to Yahweh and he prays, take vengeance on them, right? You are the God who judges righteously. You weigh people's intentions. The implication here is that Jeremiah's heart is right, right? Jeremiah has trusted in the Lord. Jeremiah has proclaimed the Lord faithfully like he's been called to do. Therefore, in this reeve that he has with the men who are plotting against him, he's calling out to God, asking for justice, and he assumes that God's response will be vengeance against even his own people. This is a difficult thing for him, right? To call God's vengeance against the men of his own house. And we find out in the following verses, actually, chapter 12, verses 1 to 6, that these are men of his own father's household that he's speaking about here. But as I said earlier, this parallels Yahweh's own anguish. And this is kind of a famous dynamic, right, in the book of Jeremiah. He's the weeping prophet, but he also reveals the heart, in a sense, of a weeping God, a God who weeps over the destruction that he himself is having to bring on his own people. And we see that in the Gospels, embodied in the flesh, in our Lord, who weeps over Jerusalem, right? So a lot of times, the weeping prophet Jeremiah is set beside the weeping Jesus over his people. Well, here in these chapters, we see both the frustration and the decided vengeance that is willed by both Yahweh and his prophet against his people. And that's really the heart of these verses. If you want to preach gospel from these verses, you really need to read 11 and 12 together and then go to the end of chapter 12. And one possible way to preach on this passage would be around the metaphor of shattered households. Shattered households in the gospel within the metaphor of reconciliation. The sin of God's people has shattered his covenant relationship with his people. Therefore, he's bringing judgment against them. The refusal to hear the word of the Lord has shattered the household of Jeremiah himself. And that's the place, I guess, that the sermon really would begin, is in this text. The focus is on the disarray and the dysfunction. This is serious family dysfunction, right? People plotting to kill someone else in the family because of the word of the Lord. And finally, towards the end of these two chapters, the middle of chapter 12, we find out there's also disruption among the nations because of this. God, in his wrath, is using nation against nation. He's plucking up both Judah and the surrounding nations from their land in judgment. But chapter 12 ends with the promise that because of Yahweh's great compassion, it implies he will restore Judah to the land. And in that day, it also promises that he will restore also the nations around them, and that they will learn the ways of Judah and come to be one people, you might say, or come to at least be unified as those in relationship with Yahweh. So there's wonderful gospel promise of macro reconciliation. All of the nations will be reconciled to Yahweh at the end of chapter 12. That, of course, is wrought through the reconciliation of his own people first, Judah, his chosen people, and the promise extends then even to individual human relationships, right? Even to the household of Jeremiah, finally, reconciliation will be brought because of the compassion of Yahweh. Why is this gospel reading set alongside the gospel? Why is this Old Testament set alongside the gospel? If you're preaching on the gospel this week and you're looking for some tie-ins to the Old Testament, first of all, it's a bit of a stretch. I mean, there is the surface sense of Jesus predicting his own crucifixion and resurrection. So Jesus, in other words, knows the plans that men are scheming against him. That's implied because he says to the disciples that he'll be betrayed into the hands of men, crucified, and rise again. However, what's missing from the Mark 9 reading that would have been an interesting parallel to this Jeremiah passage is this note of the intimacy and the close relationship of those who he's being hurt by. Matthew's passion prediction is much more specific. He actually talks about going to Jerusalem and being acted against by the chief priests, the teachers of the law. There's this clear sense that it's his own people. Or you have John 1, right? He came to those who were his own, but his own did not receive him. Those are nice parallels to this Jeremiah passage that are kind of missing in the Mark 9 reading, which just says that he'll be betrayed into the hands of men, generically. Jesus then, as he predicts his own passage, is portrayed as, by the Jeremiah reading alongside of it, being in the line of the true prophets, right? He's going to be betrayed and harmed by men because this is what happens to the prophets. It also, with this Jeremiah reading alongside the gospel reading, implies that God is in control of the process. Just like in Jeremiah 11 and 12, men are scheming. They think they're going to do all these things to the Lord's prophet, cut him down like a tree, lead him like a lamb to the slaughter. But in the end, God is the one who sees to their end, and they're the ones who are going to be cut off like a tree. They're the ones that Yahweh will lead like a lamb to the slaughter. So all of this is under Yahweh's control. It's not, events are not spinning out of control in the gospel when Jesus predicts his passion. The second tie-in to the gospel reading perhaps comes at the very end. Here in Mark 9, verse 37, "Whoever receives a child in my name receives me," Jesus says, "and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." Now think about that dynamic. Whoever receives the one sent by God receives God. And then reflect back on the Jeremiah passage where the rejection of Jeremiah by his own family is a precise parallel to the rejection of Yahweh by his people. In rejecting Jeremiah, they're rejecting Yahweh. Because they reject Yahweh, they reject Jeremiah, and so forth. Well, that's about the extent of what I have to say about Jeremiah 11, so we will pause there for a minute before the gospel reading.